Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode, holy cow, Larry, 261 of Registry Matters. Good evening, how are you?
I'm feeling really wonderful. I have had some great chiropractic treatment this past week.
You know, I made some sort of derogatory comment about chiropractic care, maybe around episode 10, and someone sent me the biggest nasty gram of all time, said, don't ever talk about that again. Not a fan. Not a fan. So anywho.
Well, it's actually...
They bounced you around and broke your back and all that?
They did all those things. They dropped me and pounded me, but I feel better today. The last treatment was yesterday, and I feel better today than I felt in some number of weeks now. So there may be something to this kabuki.
There may be. But okay, I'll leave that one alone. So do us a favor, and please feel free to go over to YouTube, like, subscribe, share, do all those nice, fine things so that people can find this video and see that you like the same content that other people like, and then that whole algorithm will kick in and we'll get more people watching the videos. Because why are we here, Larry? We're here to help people, right?
That's absolutely why we're here.
We're not here to lie to people consistently, repeatedly, over and over, and like double down and triple down and quadruple down on the same lie over and over again.
I've heard of some outlets doing that, but no, we probably make mistakes and we probably give out some information that it's not complete, but we don't deliberately do any of those things. There are channels on YouTube where I see it's just, there's no way that they believe what they're saying, but they have 70,000, 200,000 sometimes. I think I've seen one of the people who I follow is like approaching 500,000 subscribers. So apparently that's what people want.
I think that you may be onto something there. But if you do keep telling them the wrong information, then these channels that you're talking about, they're not calling out someone specific. They're not saying Acme Corporation did a bad thing so that then Acme Corporation would then come back and sue the crap out of you. You think that's like where they cross the line?
That's definitely where they cross the line. But some of the stuff that they tell people is just fear-inducing. It's all intended, in my opinion, just to cause people to be afraid. I mean, there are people who are with 250,000 subscribers telling them that the banks are all going to be shut down within a month. It's like, really, right, folks? You really believe that?
Before we get too far derailed, we have a lot of stuff to go over tonight. Please tell me what we will be doing.
We've got some questions that are submitted, some good questions, and then we've got a segment where we're going to pick up where we left off about entrapment. And we've got a couple of guests that were with us in the past. What was it, episode 252 or something like that?
If you say so.
And they're going to convince me that I'm all wrong about what I'm saying. They know that they can do it. And then we've got an article or two if we get to it.
All right, then. So let us begin from, let's see here. We have a question that came up on the YouTube channel, if I'm not mistaken. It says, what are your thoughts on this? An accused inmate is offered a plea deal. He rejects it and then is held for 3 years without a trial and finally gives up and takes the deal. What is the maximum number of years you can be held without trial?
I couldn't help myself when I read this on YouTube. This is one of the best questions that I've seen in a long time because there are so many variables. I'm not going to be able to give him an answer without knowing more information, but I can point you in the direction of what you need to look at when you ask that question. As always, facts do matter, and we don't know enough from this question as it's been presented. My first question would be, was the person already on any type of supervision at the time of the recent charge that resulted in detention without bail? If they were on supervision already, a no bond hold is not unusual at all. It's very common. It's kind of the norm rather than the exception. So another variable would be if that person had a previous criminal history, particularly any sexual offenses or crimes of violence, because then you're talking about risk to the community. And that would factor into the algorithm where they look at the releasability of a person pre-trial. And then, has the person ever missed any court dates in the past? That also is a part of the algorithm. If you have missed two court dates on your previous charges, your past behavior can be used to factor into your reliability to show up in court. But now, if none of those things, then we move forward to what would be the assumption that this was the first encounter with the law. In that situation, holding a person without bail is mostly up to the laws and practices of the jurisdiction, but they do have to be cognizant of the Sixth Amendment, I think it is, which comes into play. Unfortunately, there's no exact amount of time, and it can depend on the complexity of a case. For example, if you're charged with misdemeanor shoplifting, that's not a particularly complicated case to put together. So therefore, a speedy trial time, what would be a reasonable amount of delay for putting together a very simple case, would be far less than a complicated case that involved a whole lot of witnesses, maybe a second or third jurisdiction, maybe multiple defendants. So those type of things figure into the complexity of the case. But in addition, beyond the complexity of the case, there are actions that an accused can take and initiate. They're not counted in the computation of time. For example, if the accused raises a mental health issue and says, I'm not competent, that would suspend all the proceedings while competence is being determined. And that time would not be counted in any speedy trial calculation formula. If you, the defendant, caused a delay, you can't turn around and yell about the thing that you caused. So if you want to be evaluated for competency, since you're presumed competent, we've got to take that time out of the formula. If you're out on pretrial release and you skip trial, and that's not his question, but another example, if you don't show up in court, all the time between that schedule setting that you didn't make and appear at and the next schedule setting, all that will not be counted in the computation because you created that delay. So does that help you in any way, or are you just as confused now as you were before you read the question?
I can see where you're going with all of that, and we don't have enough information. I mean, if this was just a completely green person off the street, then I mean, if they never charge you with anything, I've always heard on TV shows, Larry, that if like we have to release them in 24 or 48 hours, if we don't have something to charge them with, I've always heard that. I don't know if that's somewhere in some sort of statute that the police have to release you. Right.
You are correct, but this one, he's been charged. He just hadn't been brought to trial. But yes, you're asking about a situation where they haven't been formally charged. I'm under the assumption on this question he has been formally charged.
Sure,
he's
been
arraigned. He's in custody, awaiting trial, and he's wanting to know how long. But yes, there are limits to how long you can hold a person, and that again varies from jurisdiction. As a general rule, you can find that the southern states are a little more conservative, which tends to be primarily the South, but not entirely. Those jurisdictions that believe in law and order are more likely to have more leniency in terms of holding a person without bail for a long period of time. You remember when the pandemic was going on in Georgia and they've all but suspended everything in the way of court proceedings? They just threw out everything to do with speedy trial. They said the courts decided, well, we're going to ignore that and the people can litigate it later. But if you tend to get into the more liberal jurisdictions where the people don't care about public safety and they're all about turning loose a tidal wave of crime on the population.
Right. Yes.
Of course, I believe that just means due process of law. I don't believe that I have no desire to turn loose a tidal wave of crime on myself, but I also have the utmost respect for the Constitution and due process that we supposedly adhere to. And if it means we have to turn a person loose, I'm okay with it. We'll have to deal with the consequences of that because the Constitution and those protections are there for a reason. But as a general rule, you'll find that the more conservative states are a little more tolerant towards those violations and extensions of time.
The only other thing, I was very young. I was very young, and I would log on to computer bulletin boards, and I would see these messages come across. It would say free Mitnick, and I had no idea what it is. Later, finding out that there's a person named Kevin Mitnick. And as I understand it, I have nothing to back this up with. He was held without charges for 5 years. The DA, we're kind of going off track here, but the DA had convinced the judge that he could launch nuclear war with just whistling into a phone. So he was denied phone calls and all that stuff. Like, but anyway, that's the way that I understand it. But that's the only time I've ever heard of anyone being held for an extremely long period of time that didn't have some sort of really violent kind of charges that, like, in the interest of safety, we can't let you go because these are the allegations against you.
I remember that. He was my partner. We used to hack into the phone systems together.
Do you remember that he was held like that?
I don't remember the specifics, but okay. Something along that line, yes.
Okay. So you know who this? You know the name of the person? I'm surprised that you know this person's name.
I heard the name. He was supposed to be the one who could do things, like you said, with his... He knew how to work the telephone system that was activated by tones, and he could whistle those tones.
Correct. All right. Well, then, so if we're done with that one, there was a part two to this question. This is from the same person, correct?
No, this was sent to me.
Oh, okay. So this is a separate person's question. And you spent a bunch of time, Larry. Where did that one go? Oh, my God. I somehow lost that question on the title.
You're right there, but I can read it.
No. I've got it. I had it up on the screen for people to read. I'll get it in there. You spent a bunch of time on justifying plea bargains, yet you never really address the obvious point that if everyone refused to bargain, then the system would crash. Can you not duck? Larry, listen carefully. Can you not duck that question and admit that the system would crash?
Now, I embellished it and put the not duck. All he said was, admit that?
That's fine.
But that was one of our loyal listeners that emailed me and said, I can't believe that you didn't answer that part. And I said, well, I don't think it was asked, but I'll answer it now. No, I cannot admit, I guess I could admit that the system would theoretically crash. I could admit that. But it's not going to happen because when we go into an attorney-client relationship, we're representing you. And the obligation, the ethical oath that the attorney takes is to try to get the best outcome for you. And we have to take a look at what your circumstances are and what evidence they have against you. And how strong the case is against you, and what would be the downside to you if you got convicted of the charges as they have been leveled by the prosecution. We can't look at some greater cause of trying to save the system or crash the system so that we can invent a new one. We're working within the system as it exists. So our job is to try to protect you. And that's why it's never going to happen. When a person's accused of a crime, we're looking at the facts as they apply to you.
I'm with you. And God, if they came at you and said, you know, if you take it to trial, you'll get 100 years. But if you take this plea, we'll give you 2. Who's not going to take that deal?
Well, there are cases where the state doesn't have a great case, but that's generally one of the factors that goes into how great the bargain is they offer you. The weaker the case, the better bargain you're going to get because they're trying to assure an outcome. The stronger the case, the less they have to negotiate because they could convict you if need be. So as an accused person, you've got to make sure their case is as weak as possible. That means not signing a confession after you've been read your Miranda rights. That means refusing to talk to them when they say, I'd like to talk to you. We're from the government. We're here to help. Said, well, I'm sorry. I don't believe that anybody from the government, your branch of the government, I don't believe you're here to help. You're here to help secure a conviction. And if you maintain that posture, their cases would be a lot weaker. But lots of times we're handed junk because the person has done everything possible to make it virtually no defense is available. They have a college education. They have told the officers on camera that they understand the English language and they read it very well and they understand it. And they sign this. They go on and on telling them graphic details of how they did what they did. And then they're surprised when they don't get a great offer because we don't need to make a great deal with you. If I'm the prosecutor, I said, well, you know what? I've got your videotape confession. I've got your signed confession. But on the other hand, if you've done none of those things, and the witness is not all that credible or maybe a little bit weak, a good deal might be offered because that closes the case with a victory. And once they get you convicted, then they don't need to try you if you mess up under supervision or in prison or both. I mean, you may get out on supervision if they give you a split sentence and you come out and they got their 3 years. They give you 5 years, three to serve, and you come out with 2 years to serve in the community. They've got two more years to stack up on you in prison if you goof up, and they don't have to put you on trial. They only have to show by the preponderance of the evidence that you violated your supervision, and you're right back behind bars. That's why they offer great deals, but the great deals are offered to people who have not turned all the evidence against themselves.
At least one follow-up is someone asks, what about the trial tax? To take it to trial, that they just throw extra stuff on you, so they're calling it a trial tax. I get it.
Well, the trial tax is being referred to comes for a number of reasons. When you do a plea bargain, you normally don't plead what we call straight up, meaning that there's concessions made. It wouldn't be a plea bargain if we said, Andy, we've got 10 counts on you, and we'll make a deal with you. You plead to all 10, and there's no cap at sentencing. Why the hell would you do that?
Right.
Why would you do that? So we say, Andy, plead to 4 of the 10, and the 4 of the 10 counts would carry a combined exposure of 40 years because they're 10 years on each count if they were stacked consecutive. We'll agree to concurrent sentencing, and we'll agree to we'll agree not to oppose probation. You've just cut your exposure down from 10 counts to 4. You've just cut your exposure down from the stacked 40 years to a concurrent 10 years, and you've just eliminated the argument that we vehemently oppose probation. That's a heck of a good deal. Well, the trial tax would be that if you went to trial, you would have the 10 times 10 stackable. So, and the judge is going to, first thing most judges are going to say after the jury comes in with a verdict, the judge is going to want to know what the last plea offer was. Because I had to sit through this 4-day trial, and I had to sit through this graphic stuff I didn't want to hear, and you got convicted of all 10 counts. What did the state offer you? That's one of the penalties. Now, there are other trial taxes, including that you don't get, like the, what is it called, mitigation. It's hard for you to argue mitigation if you've taken them to trial. So mitigation is a weak argument when you've gone to trial. So that's a form of another trial tax, because you don't get to make your case for mitigation.
And obviously, on the other side, somebody was asking about this, I think in the post show, that you also, if you take the plea deal, you lose your right to appeals and all those other things.
You lose virtually all of those rights, and they go through that with you when they're doing the plea. And as I mentioned on that episode, I wish that the defendant would actually get to articulate and be asked to articulate, that rather than just answering yes or no. I wish they would say, can you tell us, in your own words, what you're giving up here? Because we're about to take a dramatic step that can have the potential to alter your life. Do you understand what you're giving up? Tell the court. And I know right. It would not be very eloquent for many people, because they'd be scared senseless. But at least we could get a little bit on the record of what you understood at the time. Now, that works both ways. If you do a great job articulating what you're giving up, and then you decide you've had buyer's remorse, you've just screwed yourself even more than what you did with your yes or no answers.
Alrighty then. Well, let's move along. You dropped in a question. This one was typed to you. And this says, Dear Larry, I happened to be browsing through the law library and was seeking the 42 U.S. Code 1983 statute and wanted to read some of the accompanying federal laws, and discovered 42 U.S. Code 1982. All citizens of the United States shall have the same right in every state and territory as it enjoyed by white citizens, therefore to inherit, purchase, lease, sell, hold, and convey real and personal property. I am unsure what convey means in this context. However, I could read that to mean I could have it any damn color as I feel I want to display the house in a neighborhood. But under the pretext of the registry and residency restrictions, I could say I could choose whom I want to live in my property. Because the federal laws trump and is superior to state law and regulations and no residency restrictions in SORNA, wouldn't an individual be able to sue the state of blank their legal right to convey their property or rental location to be whomever they feel is appropriate themselves on the registry, even if it is across the street of a particular structure? Thank you for this judicial argument hypothesis. And because of the racial implications of this law by white citizens, if a person sues, should it be a minority? Thank you very much. Respectfully yours.
I'm going to ignore that part of the question, but I like the previous paragraph about because federal law trumps. He's actually onto something that I've been preaching for some amount of time. He doesn't do it as eloquently as he could, but I get the point of what he's trying to convey. I've said for a number of years that if I were still in property management, I think you'll remember as I say this now, if I were still in property management, I would be tempted to sue because it's none of your damn business how many PFRs I have on my property. That's a managerial decision that I will make. We will determine what's the appropriate level of that in our community. We will assume that risk, and it's none of your business to interfere with me in terms of that. And so I think that there's a case to be made along the lines of what he's trying to articulate here. If property owners and management groups step forward and say, sorry, you're interfering with an economic right of mine. I get to determine who lives on my property. I think they have a very compelling case to make along these lines.
Okay.
Now, see, I'm not all gloom and doom.
So I should change your picture from this week?
Yeah. So, he's got something that I've thought about a long time, and I would like to see some litigation. It's kind of similar to the church litigation that I would like to see. I'd like to see for churches to tell the government there is a separation clause between you, the government, and us, the congregation. We will determine if we want PFRs amongst us, and we will determine what level of supervision we provide for our own benefits, and we will determine if we want them to be around our children. This is all an internal affair of the church. Government butt out. He's making a very similar argument here in terms of this.
Yep, I understand where you're going with that. It does seem like in the interest of commerce, like, how can they tell you who you can rent to?
Well, they claim that they're not telling you that. They're saying for public safety reasons, we're trying to keep them. What do they call it when they accumulate too many in one area? They have a term for it.
It wouldn't be congregating, is it?
Congregating, maybe. But yes. They make it impossible for them to live anywhere. And then when they find a sliver of land, then they get mad because there's a group of them living there.
Yeah. And, yeah. They totally make it where you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. So we created a little community where we can kind of support each other and all that stuff with like, oh my God, there's 100 PFRs living in 1 square mile. We have to disband them, disperse them.
Yes. Well, I believe that this litigation would not be dismissed on the failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. I think this one would survive that dismissal, and I think with proper development, spending a little bit of money, it might get traction.
Interesting. How would you go about it, though? Like, who would you, a particular state that you would try to hit first? Anything of that nature?
I would try to find a willing property management group that's ready to take the public hit. Now, they're going to take a public hit, because they're going to be cast in the public eye as being pro-PFR. And that's going to be a tough sell. It's kind of like a church. I mean, that's the reason why the churches don't do that. If they were to take the public posture that we want PFRs in our congregation roaming around the nurseries here at the church, that's not going to be good for the average collection tithe on Sunday. It's not going to be good for the intake. But I would try to find a willing property management group that is fed up with governmental intervention. And I would try to get some conservative lawmakers on board, because I would go and I would spew back to them what they claim they believe in. And I would say, you claim that you believe in the fundamental right to keep the government out of the business and let business decide, because business is best prepared and qualified to to make these decisions about how to run it. And so therefore, let's remove the big bad government from this. And of course, they're going to run and duck, and they're going to squirm, and they're going to twist, and they're going to figure out some way to bypass your arguments. But if you make this argument enough time, you might find a conservative lawmaker to say, wait a minute, we shouldn't be telling ownership groups of who they can rent to and how many and these kind of things. I believe in that. But that person's going to have to be politically secure in their seat for them to be able to do that. You can't go find someone who's winning 51-49. You got to find someone who's either unopposed or winning 67-70% of the vote. That way they've got a little bit of political capital to burn.
I understand. Anything else before we move over to the cage segment?
Let's do it, because I know this is going to take a little bit of time. We've been preparing for this for 10 weeks now.
I believe that you're right there.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say F-Y-P.
I guess, well, first up, we will be bringing back Araceli. And let me do some reconnoitering here on my system so that they don't see themselves broadcast back. Because, boy, is that unnerving. I've done that before, and it messes people up pretty bad. Can you guys see me okay? All right, let's move along to the cage section. Araceli, do you have some opening comments that you want to make to get things going?
Yes. Hi. First of all, Larry's been preparing for this for 10 weeks. I haven't. I don't know why Larry spent 10 weeks. I've only been preparing it for a few days. But I'm sure Larry's got some really great answers because he's been preparing for 10 weeks now. So, okay, so to start off with, I wanted to talk about a federal law. So I want to say, if those who are convicted of soliciting a minor online are treated in our system the same, and many times even are treated even more severely than those who have actually sexually assaulted a minor, which is an actual crime of violence, then why would this crime, the crime of soliciting a minor online, not be considered a crime of violence when it comes to applying the federal law 18 U.S. Code 373, where police officers and vigilante groups have solicited men on adult dating and hookup sites to commit this crime?
On your first point, I'm not sure I agree with your statement. You said those convicted of soliciting a minor are treated in our system the same or many times even more severely than those who have actually assaulted a minor. That is, while that is in fact true, that neglects the salient point that very few contact sex offenses are prosecuted in the federal system. And the federal system is extremely harsh in penalties imposed for criminal behavior. And most contact offenses, on the other hand, are prosecuted in state courts, and state courts are free to impose their own penalties, which in many instances are less severe. And on your second point, I'm not ready to concede that the police and vigilante groups you refer to are soliciting anyone. They're acting unethically. I'll agree to that. And their behavior tempts men with a forbidden fruit. But the bottom line is the men have to disengage when the adult morphs into a teenager during the course of the relationship.
Okay. Well, federally, I mean, there is a mandatory 10-year sentence. So that's why I say it's being treated the same as a crime of violence, because I mean, that is a pretty serious penalty or a sentence. So if a lawyer
let me respond to that. Yes, you are correct. But the federal system, you're making an apples to oranges comparison. If someone gets 3 years in the state of Vermont for having inappropriate sex with a minor, that has nothing to do with the mandatory 10 years in the federal system, because the federal government through Congress has set these penalty schemes up, and the lawmakers in Vermont have set that penalty sentencing scheme up. So therefore, do you want to apply the federal law to, or do you want to require the federal law to be the state laws to mirror the federal law? The states get to decide how they sentence and punish people.
Oh, no, I was not talking about state laws at all. I'm just saying if there's a mandatory sentences of 10 years in prison for soliciting someone online, then that's clearly being treated as someone committed a crime of violence. Otherwise, why would you feel the need to lock them up for 10 years and put them on the registry for it?
We have federal guidelines that require people to get harsh sentences that don't do violent crimes. You're making a false assumption that just because it's a 10-year sentence, that means it's a crime of violence. Bernie Madoff didn't commit a crime of violence. He got a life sentence.
For a crime. But, okay. So we're getting a little off topic here. I was just thought, to me, that just seems the same as, you know, it's equivalent because it's not like, well, I won't go there. I don't know how much they give for thefts or stuff like that. Okay. So, I want to make the point, if there were, I just lost my place, sorry. If a lawyer were to use this argument that the police officers who conducted their sting operation on an adult dating or hookup site violated this federal law, again, I'm saying that it is being treated equivalent to a crime of violence. So by soliciting the men to commit this crime, and the judge were to rule against it, claiming that, nope, this is not a crime of violence, can this ruling then be used by those convicted of this crime to argue that this is not a crime of violence? So why does the punishment not fit the crime? Why the mandatory 10-year sentence? Would that not fall under the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment for something that's not a crime of violence?
A long, lengthy prison sentence does not necessarily correlate to a crime of violence. Congress gets to decide through the American people, decided through who they elected to Congress, to declare this to be a very serious offense. And I keep hearing this term crime of violence, but according to 18 U.S.C. 16, a crime of violence, and it tells you what it is, an offense that has an element of use or attempted use of threatened use of physical force against the person or property of another, or any offense that is a felony and by its nature involves a substantial risk that physical force against the person or property of another may be used in the course of committing the offense. And I've added a link to an attorney's website who's more qualified, and he goes into great detail about a crime of violence. A long sentence doesn't necessarily mean it's a crime of violence.
Okay, and I had also looked up the definition of what the crime of violence was, and I interpreted the part that says or threatened use of physical force as that part applying to this. Is that not so, or because if you're talking about sex with a minor, isn't that a threat of physical force? It hasn't been done, but wouldn't that fall under that? That was my interpretation of that.
I do so little federal work, I can't say for certain. But in the limited work that I've done, I don't remember this being on the list of crimes of violence. But it's a serious offense, there's no doubt. The American people have deemed it a serious offense. 10 years is a lengthy sentence. But we deem a lot of things in the federal system much more serious than the states do. So you could actually have committed a much more heinous violent act in many states and get less time than what you get for this. That I agree with you on. But it's not an apples to orange comparison. You would have to look at the federal statutes in terms of where they do have jurisdiction to prosecute forcible sexual offenses and what the sentences are imposed for those to do a real valid comparison. But most of the sexual offenses are not prosecuted in the federal system because there's very, very few territories where there's actual federal jurisdiction. The internet is the exception where there's federal jurisdiction, but most of the time the sexual offenses are going to be prosecuted in state court where they've been actually a contact offense.
So what you're saying is it needs to be compared to the sentences that the federal government prosecutes for crime of violence. And that's
Okay.
I'm saying the sexual offenses themselves, where there would be federal jurisdiction. There can be sexual offenses that are not crimes of violence. They can be merely against the law because of an age discrepancy, but there's no violence involved. We'd have to take a look at the sexual offenses, the whole universe. And since I do so little federal work, I feel woefully unprepared to tell you what those sentencing ranges would look like without doing some research. And I didn't do that for tonight.
Okay. So, well, my next question was going to be, and I don't know if you've kind of already answered that, but my next question was, well, isn't it an inconsistency in our system if this is treated like a crime of violence when it comes to the punishments for this crime, again, the mandatory minimum 10-year sentence, then shouldn't it also be applied when it comes to soliciting someone to commit this crime? And if so, what can be done to fix this? Because it's inconsistent.
It's a harsh penalty scheme for sure. The federal system, as I've given figures, and I'll recite those from memory just to give you some context. The federal prison population remained relatively stable from 1940 to 1980 at 20,000, roughly, going up or down 1,000 or so. And in 1980, we had a presidential election and we had a new regime come into power that promised to make America safe again. And by 1988, at the end of 8 years of that new presidency, the federal prison population, which had remained relatively constant for 40 years, had tripled to 57,000. So it's a serious, anything in the federal system is treated very seriously after the Sentencing Reform Act of 1984. And the Bail Reform Act of 1984 has resulted in a significant number of people who have federal charges being detained pretrial, as the people who were involved in the Capitol disturbance have found out. You know, a lot of them got detained pending trial. But what can be done to fix about it? Nothing, unless you can prove that the police solicited the person to commit a crime. And we're going to end this episode at the same point we did last time, because I haven't bought into that yet. But you would have to go to Congress. Congress made these laws and established these penalties. And that's where the change would have to be made, would be through congressional action. I don't see that happening anytime soon. The Congress is not in a mood right now to lighten up on criminality in any way. If you watched what happened in the last election cycle, if you remember, we talked about on the podcast, all the vilification that went around for just the modest reforms that were being talked about. If you remember the confirmation of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson about how she was vilified for being soft on this type of crime, the porn and anything related to sexual offenses in the federal system as her tenure as a federal judge before she got confirmed to the Supreme Court, it's not in the cards anytime soon.
So, Larry, would you say it would be better to use, because I get it now, we have to show specifically, you know, how they did solicit. Would it be better to take like the general tactics that they're using that we've seen across the board in these cases, or to take one specific case and specifically show, you know, and from that case, this is how they solicited? So say in general, these are the tactics they are using. This is what we've seen in all of these cases. Or, hey, look at Sebastian's case. Let me show you exactly how they did this. Is there a better way?
My thought would be to win support, and we're having the same thing with the people over in military custody that are writing to us, and we're doing episodes and segments about that. This has to come from the conservative side of the aisle. I hate to keep saying that, but you need conservative vindication for anything that's going to be perceived by the public as being softer on crime. So you have to get to the conservatives. The liberals can't really help you. And the liberals will go along if they're not going to be vilified and tarred and feathered by the conservatives. So you've got to get the conservatives, and you've got to make an appealable case, which would probably mean someone who had limited emotional development, that was what they call delayed development, and someone who was easy vulnerable to the type of tactics that they used. And then you would have to build a record of showing that this is systemic, not an isolated case, because if you just have one, they're going to say, well, you know, that was a breakdown. You know, that was, you know, that was an anomaly. So you're going to have to show that there's, this is a systemic, but you start by winning them over that this is a vulnerable, they do this to vulnerable people, because you don't get yourself in the door. When you go with a person, like I was working with a psychologist that was temporarily out of prison because he wanted appeal due to a technicality, and he was helping do some volunteer work, and he was hoping to avoid going back to prison, which he ultimately went back in November because they convicted again, just like I told him they would do. And but he was not an appealable, he was not an appealing individual, because he had a, I don't want to get too specific, but he had professional degrees. He was a practitioner and held a license. He's not going to be a candidate for going down and saying the system is abusing people, because he knows better. So you got to have the right person to start the ball rolling. And it's going to be a tough sell, but you've got to go to the people who are on the right side of the aisle politically, because they are the only ones who can do it. They will vilify if they're not in on this, and winning them over is the tough thing to do.
Well, that's very helpful to hear. And we do have some members in our CAGE group that have some good ideas for how we can do that. So thank you for that. That's helpful to hear. So about constitutional violations. So I think the search and seizure are illegal in these cases, because to begin with, there was no probable cause. They had to, there was no probable cause to be investigating or searching these men to begin with. The men were just randomly targeted on an adult website or app, which is just not logical to assume that people were on there looking for minors to have sex with. So they were targeted here, and these are places that adults use for sexual purposes to meet other consenting adults for this. And law enforcement had to create the probable cause that these men would have had sex with a minor.
I cannot totally agree with you, although I share your frustration. I certainly do. But law enforcement does indeed create crimes with these sting operations. But having said that, the legal test is whether or not the men were predisposed to commit the crime. And your argument, and I truly do get it, your argument was that they went into the room expecting adults. And they're in the room, and when an adult approaches them, and I don't do these things myself, so I don't know exactly how it works, but your argument is when they're approached by an adult, that that's where the solicitation occurs, that it's the adult who solicits them. I totally understand that, but it's just disconnected from reality. That when they are approached by the adult, they have to express righteous indignation that you've morphed into a teenager. If you truly are a teenager, you shouldn't be here. And I'm going to report you to the police, which that's actually who is already there. And the predisposition test, I wish it were a long test. And I'll tell the story about being on grand jury. I think a year later, I can talk about a little bit of the details. We had a case where the person, what they were doing, there was a group of people going out robbing massage parlors. And they were targeting primarily Asians, because that seems to be where a bulk of that business, it seems to be that that's who does that work. And they had no intention of doing anything other than robbing them of their jewelry and their cash. Well, one of the massage parlor operators decided that since they didn't find her weapon, she was going to shoot one of them in the back as they were leaving. And she shot him in the back and downed him. Didn't kill him, but he's paralyzed for life. The other person turned around and returned fire and killed her. He had no predisposition whatsoever to kill anybody. But as the law stood, and as the prosecutor convinced us, that just that predisposition for that brief moment that he turned around and made a conscious decision to open fire, but that was enough under the law. These men, when a person morphs into a minor, that is enough of a predisposition, because you're faced with a choice of disengaging or you're faced with a choice of continuing. And I think an analogy I could make would be at church. Most men don't go to church looking to hook up to have sex, as a general rule. So you would go to church, and that's not the general purpose of going to church. But if someone approaches you and they have this scantily clad teenage girl, and they tell you that, well, maybe, who knows what could happen? You have to say, you're in the house of the Lord, for God's sakes, and you're talking about this? I'm appalled that you would even suggest such a thing in such a setting like this. The answer is very simple. It really is. The men are going to have to disengage when a person morphs into a minor. And I know that's not what people want to hear.
So you have helped me understand more what the disconnect here is. And obviously, or clearly, it's that most people, I mean, including myself in the beginning, don't really understand how these hookup sites work because we haven't used them. I know a lot more about them now because of this. And I've been looking into this for years. And it's just, the problem is that it's just not a realistic situation because, and like you said, you know, somebody in church might approach you and this is something you're not expecting, but that's different. You're there in person. It can be confirmed. Online is a totally different world, especially when you are in, you know, in one of these hookup sites where role playing is very common. So to me, it's clear that the police are the ones initiating the thought of sex with a minor. It's true that they're not initiating the thought of sex altogether because the men wouldn't be there in the first place. I mean, they are in an adult place that adults use for sexual purposes. So, yeah, they were thinking about sex. But it's a fact that police basically told the men, hey, you should have sex with a minor instead of with an adult. Indirectly, that's what they did. And then they were very persistent about it, which is where I disagree that they did not just offer an opportunity. They induced it because they were persistent. They repeatedly asked. It's not a realistic situation at all because it's not normal to think, oh, yeah, this is just a 13-year-old on here looking for random adult male strangers to have sex with. That's not normal thinking. And I don't get, like, people are not getting that. And to say, oh, it's just a 13-year-old, so I have to disengage. No, you're going to be like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Why the heck are you saying you're 13? And if you are 13, why are you on here looking for random men to have sex with? Or are you really 13? It's more natural to want to find out more about the situation. If you know that this is just someone trying to play some stupid game with you and you're not interested in playing with them, then yeah, you would disengage. But if it's more natural to be confused about it and to want to know more about it, like, is this person for real? And if she is, why is she on here? And if I disconnect, she's going to move on to the next person and do this with. And I can report it to police, but it hasn't been confirmed if it's real or not. I can report it to the website. All they're going to do is remove this profile and she's going to go somewhere else. What if it is real? So my question is, why are the police allowed to continue insisting on the sexual conversation and on the sexual encounter? And because in most cases, the man is attempting to meet, they've made the conversations not about sex, but the police take away that option. It has to be about, you have to agree to sex with me. And even after the men straight out say no, they continue to harass him about it. And realistically, the goal is to meet this person in person so that you can confirm what's real or not. Why are they allowed to continue to make the conversation about sex with a minor? Why not just let the men make the conversation about whatever they want?
Well, the reason why they can do that is because the laws of the states have been created to allow that. The law enforcement industrial complex, along with the victims' advocates, have convinced the lawmakers that there are people trolling by the thousands and hundreds of thousands on the internet looking to hook up with minors. And they have carved out language in the statutory schemes that have made it okay to pose as a minor and do this. If you really find this repugnant, you need to work on start changing the law to eliminate that provision. Now, that's going to be almost impossible to do. But they're allowed to do it because the law allows them to do it, and we the people made the law.
Well, I think the problem is that the law needs to clarify that this needs to be done on the platforms where the kids are hanging out, not on the adult hookup sites where nobody has seen children doing this. And if there are children doing this on those adult hookup sites, then why haven't police found them and rescued them from there or removed them from there? They've never put out any information about minors on these websites doing this. It does not add up. So I think the law needs to be clear on that these sting operations need to be conducted on the platforms that children are on, not on the adult sites where no one goes expecting to find children. I mean, that part just does not make sense.
I agree with you.
Thank you. So let's talk about the case United States versus Mayfield. This is a 2014 case, and they explained what inducement is. And they basically said, you know, it requires more than just an ordinary, you know, situation. The government has to be persistent or persuasive, and the nature of the enticement or reward to be more than the typical enticements and temptations that the crime or criminal actors pose to a defendant. So it explains that ordinary means something close to what unfolds when a sting operation mirrors a customary execution of the crime. And this is where I, you know, disagree, because they're not creating realistic situations. They're creating very unusual situations. So, I mean, I think it's BS to expect anybody to have a normal response to something that's just extremely strange, like the situations are creating. But anyway, fraudulent representations, which is, you know, the case in all of these, repeated attempts at persuasion, that's happening. This is systemic. If the men don't give in right away, if they stop communication, they get harassed. Promises of reward. I say, you know, they agreeing that I'm going to meet with you, but only after you tell me that you're going to have sex with me, and you have to specifically tell me what you're going to do to me. That's the reward. The reward is I want to meet you because I want to know what's real or not. You're withholding the meeting until I play along with your game. And then I think they're also indirectly presenting a threat by saying, if you don't tell me what I want to hear, then I'm going to move on to the next man. And guess what? He's going to tell me what I want to hear, and he's going to get to meet me. So I do see this as inducement. Please, based on need, sympathy, or friendship, same thing. They target the men's manhood, like, oh, you're chicken. Oh, you're just scared, or you're not brave enough. And I mean, how is that not inducement?
Well, it is. It is some inducement. But let's look at the Mayfield case. Leslie Mayfield was indicted for conspiring with a coworker at a drug courier to rob a stash house controlled by the courier suppliers. The conspiracy was a setup. The drug courier was under government cover government agent, and the co-worker was an informant. At his trial, Mayfield wanted to present a defense of entrapment, but the government opposed it and moved to preclude the defense, arguing that there wasn't enough evidence to show the government induced the crime and that Mayfield lacked the predisposition, meaning that he had the predisposition. Mayfield responded with a narrative of the informant's persistent campaign, which you're talking about, to secure his participation in the self-stash robbery and repeated resistance to the scheme. The district court, the trial court, granted the government's motion, meaning that the defense was barred, and a jury was not instructed on entrapment defense, and they convicted Mayfield of several federal crimes stemming from the conspiracy. But a divided panel of the Seventh Circuit ended up affirming, and then a petition for full court review en banc was granted, and they reversed. And then I hand this off to Andy, because I've been reading too much and stumbling.
Do you want me to read the... I see where it is. A Mayfield court clarified, entrapment is a defense to criminal liability when the defendant was not predisposed to commit the charged crime before the intervention of the government's agents, and the government's conduct induced him to commit it. The two elements of the defense, lack of predisposition and government inducement, are conceptually related but formally and temporally distinct. Who decides if a person has been entrapped, Larry?
The entrapment defense is an issue of fact for the jury, and the Seventh Circuit clarified that a defendant is entitled to an entrapment jury instruction if he or she can show some evidence that supports both elements of the defense. When the issue is raised before trial on the government's motion to preclude the defense, the court must accept the defendant's factual proffer as true. It's kind of like summary judgment. So we have to accept the proffer and not weigh the evidence against the government's counterstatement of the facts. The court stated here Mayfield proffered enough evidence to justify giving the issue to the jury. He provided some facts showing that he was not predisposed to commit the charged crimes prior to being approached by the informant, which is what Arcelli is saying. And he narrated a story of substantial government inducement going beyond a mere offer or chance to rob the stash house. His story may be false or unpersuasive, but that's for the jury to decide, according to the Seventh Circuit. They held that the district court committed error by crediting the government's evidence over Mayfield's and precluding the entrapment defense before trial. They vacated the judgment and they remanded it for a new trial. It means he doesn't get away with it, but it means that he gets a chance to put on the defense that he was denied.
So I think really we need to educate the defense lawyers about this, because I mean, it's clear either they're not getting it, but to us, it just seems like a lot of them have just been a big part of trying to keep this going, because of course it's money for them too. It's cases for them. And it just seems like there's so many people that benefit from these cases. Therefore, a lot of people that work in the system want to keep it going. And, but I mean, yeah, it makes sense. Some of the lawyers just probably need to, they're unaware. They just need to be more educated about this. So my next question is, can the police officers who targeted men on an adult dating or hookup site to solicit them to commit this crime, can they be held liable for failing to perform their actual jobs, which is supposed to be, they're supposed to be protecting children online? And by conducting these on online hookup sites and dating sites, they're creating these cases. So they're not protecting children online, and they're receiving funding to protect children online. They're lying to the public about what they're actually doing, because these men were not targeting children online. And this has caused real harm and real damage to the men they solicited for this. These are cases that would have never existed had police not created them. Can the police be held accountable or liable for doing this?
No, not in my opinion. They're performing as their command staff has ordered them to do, and they are not their own bosses. That's the general rule. So in my opinion, no.
So to me, that sounds like then the police departments or ICACs should be held accountable for this. Because that's just, I mean, that's wrong. So, but from what I've heard about qualified immunity, this only applies when law enforcement can show that they were doing their job. And they have to be able to show that their actions were reasonable and something that any other police officer would have also done in their position. So to pose as an adult to begin with on an adult site to supposedly catch child predators, that's not really doing their job.
So that's not exactly the best description of qualified immunity. The issue on qualified immunity comes into play when there's a constitutional violation or some violation of some clearly established right. It doesn't have to be a constitutional right, but it has to be clearly established. And the fact that you don't personally approve of law enforcement's priorities, it's not a constitutional violation, and it wouldn't be subject to qualified immunity. The test you're trying to apply is that you're trying to say that the police officer, because they're not doing the enforcement on the websites and doing it in a way that would be consistent with your belief of how they would catch more people, that has nothing to do with qualified immunity. Qualified immunity has to do when the police, acting under the color of law, they deprive you of something that you have a right to have. And so the argument goes that the officer is protected by qualified immunity if they're discharging their duties responsibly. But if they disregard a clearly established right, for example, we talk about the interstate compact, you have a right to a probable cause hearing before you're transported across the country. If they deprive you of that constitutional right, that has been established since 1972. That's a clearly established right. So therefore, the police, they would not be entitled to qualified immunity on that claim, because they knew better and they did it anyway.
So we would have to show how this applies to a constitutional right.
Or an established right. It doesn't have to be a constitutional right, but something that's been clearly established.
Like the First Amendment right.
Well, that is constitutional.
Because that's something like that has been brought
marriage.
Up and it's actually being marriage looked would into, be
right? Marriage would be an example, right?
Yeah, that I think that's a constitutional right, but something that's clearly established. It doesn't have to be in the Constitution, but you have it as a matter of a statutory right, and it's clearly established that the police should not be treating you the way they're doing, and they're ignoring that process and that right. Then their qualified immunity evaporates.
Okay, well, that's helpful to hear, because then that tells me we have to show exactly, what rights they violated. For example, the right to be on an adult hookup site, to want to find other consenting adults to have a sexual encounter with. I mean, that's nobody else's business. They weren't hurting anybody.
Well, good luck with that. They have the right to be there. They're there. They just don't have the right to hook up with minors while they're there, but go ahead.
And they have the right to not be targeted by somebody who's pushing on them or forcing on them the idea of sex with minors.
I don't know that they have that right. I think that person has the right to speak anything they want to speak.
Right. So if they want to speak and say, okay, yes, I agree to sex with someone pretending to be a minor, that should be a First Amendment right, because it is logical to assume that this is just a person, an adult who maybe just gets turned on by pretending to be a 13-year-old. I mean, it could be a 40-year-old woman that just likes to pretend to be a 13-year-old girl, and she's trying to hook up with a younger guy.
Yeah, I get
that. I mean, realistic.
I get the role play argument. Yeah. So.
Yeah. And see, that's what one of the big problems is with these cases. But anyway, moving on. So what if we can show that police are using similar tactics to what they use to force false confessions? For example, when they force a false confession, they are removing options. So they're not, and then, so it's, this is the information that their target provides is not voluntary. And police will then turn around and say, oh, this was voluntary. Nobody made them do it, but they are making them say it. For example, they withhold the meeting until the men give in and play along. If the men say, hey, let's go to the mall or let's meet at a restaurant, oh, no, you have to tell me about sex. I'm not going to go meet with you and the men finally, catch on. Oh, you want to hear about sex? Well, yes, this is an adult sex website. This is what people do on here. Oh, okay. Yes. Okay. We're going to do this or whatever. Hey, can we meet now? That's what's happening with these. So if they had not withheld the meeting until the men, gave in and played their game with them, a lot of these men would never have taken it to sex. Once this person claimed to be a minor or whatever. And then they also present the threat of, well, if you're not going to tell me if you're not going to play this game with me, I'm going to move on to the next man and I'm going to get him to play along with me and I'm going to go meet him. To me, that's forcing the guy into the situation where he has to say that he will agree to it. And no, they did not prove that this man would have had sex with a minor. They proved that they can make a man or many men say that they would agree to sex with a minor. That's what they proved. That is a huge difference. And this really matters because the whole goal from the beginning when you're on one of these websites is to meet the person that you're chatting with. So why not force the conversation in the meeting to be about sex? Why not just agree to meet in person, which is a natural, normal thing to do, and let the men confirm what is real or not? And praise them. I mean, if they didn't talk about sex, but they want to meet this person to find out who this is and why they're doing this, why not just praise them for saying, hey, good for you for not trying to groom this minor and to have sex with them? Why force them into the sexual conversation? Because that's just not realistic. It's not something a real minor would do.
Well, I have sympathy for your arguments. They're unpersuasive from a legal standpoint. The men are not forced to have the meeting. They could say, I'll tell you what, I will come meet with you, but we absolutely will not engage in any sex. I find it repugnant. Even the thought of having sex with a 13-year-old, I'm 97 years old. They could do that, and they don't do that. So,
well, many have done that, and they continue to get harassed. But then also many of them just think that this is an older woman who just gets turned on by pretending to be a 13-year-old. And well, that's the First Amendment right there too. It's like he can play that game if he wants, and that doesn't make him a child predator or a predator at all. And that's just wrong to assume that that proved that he was going to go rape a minor. That's if it was Facebook, maybe, but not on here, not on one of these sites.
You're correct that talking about it doesn't, but when you agree to that you will have sex and you show up, it's no longer talk, it's action at that point.
They weren't given a choice.
They were given a choice. They could have said, no, I find this morally repugnant. I will not have sex with a 14-year-old.
Many have still been charged and convicted, even though they did that, because these chat logs also get altered. And that's another big problem. That's a whole other conversation.
Sure it is. All right. So,
but I'm going to let Heidi take over.
Right. Araceli, you did awesome. Thank you very much for coming back. No stuttering, no ums. It was great.
Thank you.
And
thank you, Larry.
Joining us now is Heidi. So let me do some muting and unmuting. Heidi, welcome. How are you?
Thank you. I'm well. How are you?
Doing fantastic. So you have a couple follow-up questions that you want to ask the Larryinator. So I'm sorry, Larry, that we're like tag teaming against you. We have two ladies to ask you questions. And so you're the punching bag for the evening. Are you ready?
Sure.
Okay. So here's Heidi. Thanks for coming on, Heidi.
Yes. Well, thank you for having me. I know we're about out of time and I really feel like my questions probably warrant its own episode. So what I'd like to say is that obviously all the things that Araceli so passionately speaks about are very near and dear to my heart also. And what I've been able to glean from this unfortunate experience is that really, I guess where we need to start is with reforming the ICAC federal funding requirements of how state police and local municipalities get funding, because currently there's just an operational, you know, procedures standard that no one follows. And so I think, I don't know how you guys are on time. I don't really know how this works, but I think I'd like to table it if we could and maybe set it up for another date.
That sounds awesome.
How do you feel about that, Larry?
That sounds awesome, because we are up against the clock and we wouldn't be able to do your justice on your questions. And it's kind of rude for you to come in prepared and us say, oh, we're out of time. But that would be awesome, because these are important issues. They really are. How we deploy resources. Those are important issues, but you guys, the legal arguments that you've put forth are just not compelling so far.
Oh, I understand. And I look forward to, now that you've taught us so much, and I so appreciate your experience and advocacy in this, in everything that you do. And I would love to save my stuff for another time.
Very well. I do want to point out something that we're not your enemies, and I'm not saying this to you, Heidi or Araceli. I want to make the general statement, though, that these laws are impacting your children and so forth in a completely egregious way, and I do feel that there's a lot of shenanigans, shall we say, that goes on here. But I want to mainly point out that this program is directed towards your group of friends and family, as well as the whole registrant community, because when your children are charged with these crimes, they most likely end up on the registry. Therefore, they're what we call a PFR. They are a person forced to register, is what that term means. And that's what this program is. It's called Registry Matters for a reason. It is about the registry. It's about fighting it. It's about trying to cope with it. It's how to deal with your probation and all these extra bullshit laws that and restrictions that they put on you. A friend of mine in Florida says that they're trying to pass a new law that makes all PFRs licenses bright red. That sounds ridiculous. So I just want to make sure that, like, you are among friends. We're not your adversaries. That's the word I was trying to search for this whole time, is we're not your adversaries in this whole cause. We just we're fighting from a different point of view as far as the subject matter of what we're dealing with.
I understand that, and I see you as my fellow advocates for everyone. And let me tell you, this whole experience has educated me on registrants and all the bullshit, and I'm a registrant advocate now, regardless, as well as an entrapment. Government against entrapment, or citizens against government entrapment advocate.
Gotcha. Well, cool. So we will work out maybe something closer to the DARSAW conference, which is towards the middle end of June, to do another segment on this.
Sounds great. Thank you guys so much.
This is one where it doesn't end, because these operations are going to continue and probably intensify, because they work. And therefore, it's something that we don't just do one time and then forget about it, because people need to be on notice. You've got to. The only hope you have is disengaging, and it's difficult, and we know that. It really is.
Very good. All right, then I'm going to, if I do this, it's going to blow up, I think, Larry. So I'm going to try really hard. Did it blow up? It didn't blow up. Hooray. All right, so I can start my virtual camera again, and now you guys can see what we're going to talk about. Cool. We will continue on. You put this thing in here, Larry, about the Georgia House voted 95-81 on Wednesday to pass Senate Bill 63, which would have required cash or property bail for 31 additional crimes, including some misdemeanors. But the House and Senate could not agree on a final version, and the measure failed to pass as the 2023 session ended just after midnight on Thursday. What does this mean when it says they could not agree? It looks like if it passed the House, 91, but then the Senate couldn't do it. Anyway, they could not agree.
Well, it was two different versions. We probably should take this up on the next episode, because the session is over. But it did not make it through the journey. But I wanted to get into a deeper dive about what's going on behind the scenes in Georgia, and I don't think time's going to permit. But you had an amended version, and it would needed to go back to conference and have that process where there's negotiations between the two chambers, and then there would have been a conference vote on the adopting the report. But I want to dig into this a little bit in terms of Georgia's political posture, in terms of how they're moving backwards on criminal justice.
All right. Well, then I guess it means you're saying we're going to close out the show.
It's getting to that point. Yes.
All right, then. Well, want to thank everyone for coming in. I really appreciate when the Cage folks show up, they bring like a whole arsenal of people. They bring a whole brigade of people that come in and join in live chat. Makes it super exciting and fun. But obviously, go over to registrymatters.co and find show notes and FYP education for the transcript and things like that, and other free resources. You can look at all the most all the history shows, transcripts and stuff like that. And don't forget to support us on Patreon at patreon.com/registrymatters. I almost messed that up. Larry, what are you doing this weekend?
I can't think of anything after this.
You're probably going to go take a nap. You know, we're going to switch over and move everybody in so that they can talk and unmute, and then your computer's going to die. No, I'm not singing Aracella. Sally, sorry. Closing time. All right. Anyway, Larry, I hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks. See you in a couple of weeks. We're skipping next week, folks. So we'll be back in 2 weeks.
Yep. Take care. Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.